Welcome to the Holy Shit Podcast. Frank and Patsy get together to discuss the issues of the moment. You know, the things that make you say, holy shit. Here are your hosts, Master Hapkidoist, Patsy Zarilla, and Attorney Frank Natel, Esquire.
Even before you start, that was a preemptive shh. Just know I have a whole bag of shh with your name on it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Holy Shit Podcast, episode number 34 for October 16th, 2019. I am your co-host, Patsy Zarilla.
And I'm co-host Frank Natel.
And, boy, Frank, we had a debate last night. Not exactly something new, but I would like to hear your thoughts about our latest Democratic debate. How you think anybody did? Who you thought the winner and loser was? And any general feelings about the debate itself? Just tell me what you think.
Yeah, I guess my biggest takeaway is there's a very real awareness, I think, in the Democratic camp amongst all the candidates that Elizabeth Warren is really emerging as a very, very strong. She's really gaining. I think they see that she's gaining the share of votes that are available to be picked up. Support is picking up on her end. So you see that in how they're treating her and how they're trying to attack her. And I just think that's, to me, that's the biggest takeaway. And I guess in my mind, you know, in terms of talking points anymore, you know, we don't really see these zingers. And if you do, they seem kind of contrived and they don't really have the staying power that, you know, sir, I knew John Kennedy. I served with John Kennedy. You, sir, know John Kennedy. You know, we don't see those kind of comments come out of these debates anymore, or quotes that really, you know, have lasting power. And that's fine. I mean, I think it's more of can these people sustain under the hot glare and the competition for the long run, which is going to make them, you know, a more viable candidate at the end to take on whoever the Republican party person may be. I guess it's going to be Trump. Who knows? But, you know, he is the president at this point.
Yeah, fair point. How did you think Elizabeth Warren handled herself, considering that she probably was attacked more last night than anywhere else? I mean, being the front runner, yeah, of course she's going to be. And I don't think any of the attacks were really off. I don't want to say off base, but were over the top or anything like that. I thought, you know, they were good, they were fair. But how do you think she parried them?
I thought she did fine. I mean, I think she could be a little bit better, but I think she's, you know, her style is one that's more centrist in general. She's got a lot of very liberal left ideas, but in her way of talking, in her way of communicating to people. And I know this angers people sometimes on the left. She's got an ability to, I guess, sidestep things in a way that doesn't leave her boxed in. And I think she did that for the most part last night. And I think she's smart enough to realize that that's not the strongest attack she's going to sustain. So I think she just played it with enough Hapkido as she could, where she just deflected enough, right? That's kind of my take on it.
I thought, you know, she was definitely in a position that she was never in before, right? And I mean, you know, the state things are one thing, but whenever you got 11 other people gunning for you, I think overall, considering, and this is going to be hard to say about Elizabeth Warren, but considering her lack of experience being on this end of the debate, right? Normally she's the one who's doing the attacking, not normally the one that's being attacked. Right. I thought that her lack of experience kind of showed, but honestly, I didn't think she did too bad a job. I mean, you can tell she was not used to being, you know, she was not used to being Joe Biden, right? She was not used, but I thought she handled herself overall pretty well. She dropped the ball a couple of times, but like I said, she was never the front runner for Democratic nominee for president before.
Right. And I agree with you. I mean, like I said, I don't think she was stellar, and I don't think she took her best counter punches last night. I think she's holding those back. There's going to be a time where she has to cut it loose. I do agree with you that some of it has to do with the lack of being the hunted and always being the hunter in the past.
Right.
But, you know, I get a sense from her that she's ready for this moment. And I think she wasn't going to do anything last night that jeopardized her campaign. I really think that's part of the strategy, in the sense of, you know, she's going to kind of continue to take gradual steps forward, as opposed to, like, she didn't have to knock anybody out last night, right? She just needs to not really hurt herself.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I agree with you. I thought she did a pretty good job, but I thought this was a really, I don't want to say wake up call for her, but I think she knows what to expect now. And I think that the next debate, regardless if she's still on top or not, I think you're going to see a much more prepared Elizabeth Warren in the debate. Anybody
that you thought? One quick thing before we leave the topic of Elizabeth Warren.
Okay.
I would say I've watched some interesting just talking points from financial sector videos, and they tend to lean right, if not heavily towards, you know, Trump a lot of times when I watch these videos. And this one, I think it was from Yahoo Finance. And there was a guy on there, I can't remember his name. If I find it today, I'll certainly give it to you so we can post up with this this edition of our pod. But the guy is a financial guru, and he was talking about how the Republicans are doing themselves a disservice by attacking Joe Biden so heavily right now because of Trump's fear that Biden could beat him personally one-on-one. And this guy's point was, the scarier thing to him as a financial guy, and he showed his slip, so to speak, was Elizabeth Warren, because in his mind, Elizabeth Warren plays better nationally than Biden does. And he was saying that the Republicans are focusing on the wrong candidate, and they're going to allow Elizabeth Warren to win this primary eventually, and she can win the presidency. In his mind, he's like, she really can win, and she scares me because I'm worried about her coming in and breaking up certain, you know, financial sectors and things like that. And this is a guy that's in banking. And of course, you know, when the bankers can run roughshod over the consumers like they do when a Biden is in office, when a Trump is in office, when a Bush is in office, then these guys make money hand over fist and damn to anybody else that, you know, is trampled along the way. But Elizabeth Warren has cut her teeth on not allowing that to happen. And she's the type of candidate that can speak to the common man and woman and say, look, I've done these things to support and protect you. That's who I am. That's what I'm about. And it's going to appeal. It's going to appeal to the blue collar workers. And I really have a belief that's going to carry on. And you see that fear from the big bankers when you hear even the Democratic big money people say, we won't support her. So, you know, that's my last point on Warren. I know you want to get into some of the other folks, but I just think it's very interesting that if you want to know who's the most who's the most viable candidate, listen to the other side. At least listen to the under the current other side, because you know, Trump himself, he doesn't understand. He just thinks he sees Biden as the former vice president, and that's the guy, mano a mano, that's going to take me down, and I'm worried more about him, and I want to knock him out while I get the chance. Meanwhile, the person who's going to really lay you bare is Elizabeth Warren.
You know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I remember, like, after the first debate, all of the Russian bots and everything went crazy attacking Kamala Harris, right?
Right.
Because she looked like she was going to be the person who took this thing by the horns and decided to run with it. Now, I'd be real shocked if it wasn't, these bots aren't going after Warden right now.
Yeah.
You know, I think that in a way it's good. And if you're on the outside looking in, you can understand these things and understand what's happening and watch it. It tells you who they're afraid of. But if you're one of if you're who they're targeting, and you're not aware of what's going on, is a very dangerous thing that that is going on. Real quick, your three biggest winners and three biggest losers.
Well, I mean, I would just say by
no particular order.
Yeah, by the virtue of what we talked about, even though she didn't swing out strong at people, I just think overall, I still put Elizabeth Warren as a top three winner. I'd say Beto O'Rourke, with his performance and follow-up to the performance last night, is a winner. I mean, I think that to the left crowd, to the people that are on the left, strongly on the left, and are going to play well in the primary, I think he's made strides. I don't know that he's made enough strides to win enough votes in the primary, but certainly with last night's performance, he's starting to appeal to more and more people. I wish he wouldn't have been in such a doldrum or a funk for so long, because I think he's a serious candidate for serious times. He's got, you know, he's super intellectual. He's a good fighter, and he connects well with people. And I think that that showed a little bit last night. You know, beyond that, I really struggle to find, you know, a clear cut winner. I would say, you know, Biden thrives in those kind of scenarios because he's been in the spotlight for so long, but he's another guy that just doesn't hurt himself in these types of situations. He's hurt himself with offhanded comments from time to time and being weird from time to time. But in these debates, because he's just so polished at debates and he's polished for these kind of events, you know, he's another one that didn't really, he's still polling at 1% higher than Warren. You know, so you have to say this is doing him no harm and probably just keeping him out in front.
Yeah. Joe actually doesn't do half bad during the debate things. And you're right. As long as he's kind of like where Warden's going to get to, as long as he doesn't do anything to really hurt himself, I think he's going to be fine. My three winners, I think for the night, I think Warren did a good job, and I think she's probably one of the three. I think Joe did a good job, and I think that Buttigieg did far better than a lot of people thought he was going to do. As for my three losers, who's the billionaire that's on there now? That's still for some reason got in this thing. God, I can't think of his name.
Not Schultz. He's not a Democrat.
Why can't I think? This is killing me that I cannot think of his
Yang? Name. Yang?
No, not Yang. Hickenlooper?
Oh, Hickenlooper. Is he still around?
Why can't I think of his name? Why can't I think of his name? Steyer. That's it. Steyer. Good thing my wife's listening in. I don't think he did himself any favors. I think that What's her name? Tulsi Gabbard shouldn't even be there anymore. I don't understand why the hell she's there, because, well, I have my own feelings about her. At this point, I just think she's a Russian plant. Andrew Yang didn't do a whole lot to impress me either. I thought Kamala Harris had a decent night. I thought Cory Booker had an average night for Cory Booker. Not too great, not too bad. Really didn't move. Isn't going to move the needle either way. Klobuchar pretty much the same way. She had a couple of good ideas, but at the end she kind of fizzles out and runs out of gas. I guess my biggest problem, Frank, and one of the things I wanted to touch on after we did our winners and losers, is we have our first Democratic primary in February, I want to say. Why do we still have a dozen candidates on stage? Well, what the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be doing itself any favors by putting 12 people up on that stage.
You know,
at least four of them shouldn't be there. I mean, they have about as much right being there as I do. Why are they doing this? They're just muddling their own message, and they're not giving anybody anything to bite onto. They're just giving them little nibbles. They're not giving them the steak. They're giving them little pieces of meat.
It's almost like they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, though. I mean, you remember the cries after the last Democratic nominee, which were they froze out Bernie. You know, this is a process where people are handpicked by the Democratic National Committee. The people don't get their chance to speak. The people don't get their chance to select their candidate. It's more the Democratic National Committee that makes those choices for the people. And, you know, I think they're trying to avoid that kind of criticism on one hand. You know, and I think that they're trying to give people the opportunity to kind of be self-selected out. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, I don't know that folks, you know, that can't sustain this candidacy will hang on much longer. You might see a few more people drop out after last night because, look, if the polling numbers don't move for them in any significant way and the financial numbers don't move for them in any significant way, what are they doing? You know, what is it they're getting out of this? And I do think that because most of those folks, you know, if you examine them individually, most of them are pretty smart. You know, Tulsi Gabbard, she's a fairly smart individual, and I don't know that she's doing this for the presidency. Like you said, she may have ulterior motives. And her aside, because of those ulterior motives, the other people who do have some intelligence are going to examine the situation and say, you know, what am I getting out of this in the long run? If I want to run for a Senate seat again, is this helping that? If I want to maintain my position as a governor of, you know, Montana, which, you know, he was in this race at one time and he decided, look, it's better for me to drop out and refocus on that now. So I think that those folks they will get it on their own. And it's better if they do that than if the Democratic committee starts pushing people off the stage. They're doing it in a way by saying you have to have this many donations and supporters so that, and polling numbers so that, you know, you qualify, because then it can't be argued that, hey, the people didn't choose, because in a sense, if the people are choosing to keep you there, then you're there. But if the people aren't choosing to keep you there, then sorry, you're not on the stage anymore.
I agree with you. I'm saying that their standard is too low.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, let's look at it this way. Just tell me yes or no. Do you think it's, I'll give you a name. You tell me if you think they have an average or better than average chance of winning the nomination. All right, let's go with the brain dead ones to begin with. Joe Biden, yes or no?
Yeah.
Yeah. Elizabeth Warren, yes or no?
Yes.
Sanders, yes or no?
I mean, his chances are fading, but yes.
Yeah, still does, right?
Yes.
Okay, so there's three. So we're at a quarter of them right now.
Right.
Klobuchar.
If things would happen in a certain way, I mean, she'd have to have a lot of lucky breaks, but yes, it's an outside shot, but yeah.
It's an outside shot. Harris.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. I would feel more confident about her than Klobuchar.
Okay, so, yeah, like I said, I'm just throwing these out as I remember the names, yeah. To be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Castro.
No.
No, he doesn't have a chance. Gabbard.
No.
No. Yang.
Oh, no, but I want to come back to him in a second, but I'm going to say that he doesn't have a chance.
Okay, so right now we went through eight and four of them have a chance. Okay?
Yep.
So right away we cut it in half. What's his name? Steyer. Does he have a chance?
He's another one that would really like. He would have to have some incredible, crazy, lucky breaks to have it happen. But he's like a Jimmy Carter to me. Like in that era of bygone days, where somebody can emerge from nowhere and do it, because he's got so much financial, you know, strength in his arsenal, I'd give him like that one in 1 in 100 chance.
Okay, so realistically saying, no, I mean, yeah, it's possible, but let's be honest. No, he really doesn't. So
no.
You're looking at some of these folks who we said no have no shot. Why are they taking up airtime and space and drawing attention to themselves when they don't have a chance anyhow? Why is the Democratic Party letting them do this?
Okay, let's go back to Yang, for example. Because when you have somebody like Yang up on that stage, and he opens up avenues of discussions and debates and talking points that I think can be adopted within the tent. And I think that, you know, you have to have that opportunity by, look, I know it's a strange, or not strange, but people get tired of the word diversity, but you know, it's important, I think, to have that diversity because you have different ideas on the stage that are being introduced. If you didn't have those people up there, you wouldn't hear about them. They wouldn't be in the same national spotlight. Do I think they're winning ideas? No. But sometimes they can be co-opted. Sometimes they can be adopted and co-opted by other candidates and part of their format. And if they weren't there to test or poll those ideas, so to speak, amongst the electorate, you might not ever get that litmus test being done.
Did you hear anything about immigration last night?
Not that I can recall.
You know why? They never touched on it. How about climate change?
No, they weren't going to touch on it.
Never touched on it. What about race relations?
Nope.
Nope. You know why? They didn't have time because they had a dozen fucking people on that stage. Right? Yeah. The things that are big, right? Immigration is huge among people. Right, climate change, especially on the Democratic side, is big, and no one heard anything about these things because you have the Tulsi Gabbards of the world making excuses for what's his face in Turkey, and then Buttigieg had to slap her around a little bit,
right?
And all that bullshit does is take time.
Well, it's true, and I can't argue with you. I know what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. But I also think that if we close off the voice of a lot of people, we might miss opportunities. And I think we know where most of the real core of the Democratic Party stands on the issues of climate change and immigration. What I honestly would like to hear more of is what's the plan for education?
Mm-hmm.
What's the plan for cost-effective education beyond high school and training workers? And maintaining a workforce.
Yep.
What's the plan for healthcare moving forward, where we're going to have a real sustainable healthcare system that both affords the healthcare practitioners with the opportunity to sustain their living, but provide top-notch healthcare at a cost that's reasonable to the public? And who has a plan to do that, and how is it going to be done? Right. You know, those kind of things I think are more important, and I want to hear that from the candidates. You know, and let's face it, how are you going to address across the aisle and across America? Because you're going to speak to the Democratic people right now, the people who are registered Democrats, but you're also going to eventually have to speak to the independents and the Republicans that we want to break away from Trump and maybe reclaim some of the Democrats that are Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin Democrats. So I quite frankly want to hear how you're going to navigate the two lightning rod issue. How are you going to navigate these voters that go in there and they pull a lever simply because you say you're pro-choice or you're pro-life, or you pull a lever because the Democrats are going to come take my guns away from me? Mm-hmm. Okay. Those two issues, you're going to have to know how to navigate. And I think Democratic strategists, and I have some ideas, and I'm not going to give them away freely on this podcast today because I don't want any Republicans to be able to beat these ideas, but you and I could talk about them in private, Patsy. I'll gladly share them with you at that point.
I would love to hear.
We can even start our own consulting business. And I can tell you right now, I've got the strategy how to beat Trump in those four states. And it includes talking on those two points and one other very important point. But in any event, I want to hear more about both.
Yeah. And it's something, Frank, how immigration ties into all of that.
Right? Absolutely.
And we heard nothing about it. I have a hard time with well, let me back up. Because we have a couple other things we want to talk about, so I want to put this thing to bed real quick. Something that came up last night that I didn't hear, which I was kind of glad was brought up, and I'll be honest, I love the way both Joe and Bernie handled it. Was the age thing came up, right? I think it was Aaron Burnett that asked him about his. He was the oldest candidate in the field, and he had to address the issue of whether his age was a problem or something. And I thought he handled things pretty well. I thought Biden handled things pretty well whenever it was thrown at him, where he said something like, you know, one of the reasons I'm running is because of my age and experience, which I thought, because I with it comes wisdom or some shit like that, that he came up with, which I thought was an absolutely brilliant response. I thought that they all did a good job, and I was very happy to see, you know, that CNN finally addressed this a little bit and said, hey, look, you guys are old. You know, and let's face it, 78 is old, right? Warren's going to be 71 if she gets nominated, right? On Inauguration Day, she'll be 71. Now, to be honest, she doesn't look or act like a 71-year-old. Joe doesn't act like, how the fuck old is Joe? God damn. He'll be 80, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's or at least he'll turn 80 whenever if he gets the nomination. If he would win, he's president, he'll turn 80 his first term. Early in his first term, Sanders is 78. Now, Bernie looks like he's 78, and he kind of acts like he's 78. Joe doesn't act like a guy pushing 80, right? And Elizabeth Warren doesn't act like somebody who's 71 or pushing, you know. But I thought they all handled things really, really well. And I just wanted to hear you real quick before we kill this thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the way around, it's something that it's like, look, it's one of the elephants in the room. You know, how progressive are we going to be as a party if we're going to be nominating, you know, 80 octogenarians to lead the party and to lead the country? But I do think that you have some, I guess there's a certain level of comfort from the age's wisdom and things like that we talked about. And we, you and I are proponents of them to some extent, but there's also this element of, I think there's an element of, it's hard to get away from the idea that that Biden is part of the establishment. His 80 years, you know, is 80 years in the establishment. Bernie Sanders has been the rabble rouser, and he's been able to, you know, wear that hat, but he's still, you know, he's still been a senator for a hell of a long time. He's still kind of been there all this time. So that's the next element to the age thing that I wonder how that's going to go, because you guys have been there and really, what have you done to improve this country, so to speak? And I think that's something we have to answer for. So they answered it fine last night. The questions were necessary. You know, I want to turn one last thing, one little last nugget about last night to, and I think this is an interesting thing. You know, the Democratic Party is one that's often seen as less hawkish, more dovish, doesn't really address the military as much as, you know, the Republicans have co-opted the military. They like to wave the flag and they like to talk about how they're big military supporters. But on the debate stage last night, and I think this is an important thing, and it's one of the reasons why I talk about kind of having a bigger stage. You had two combat veterans on that stage last night in the Democratic Party running for the nomination of the Democratic president. However relevant we think either of them are ultimately to that question or to being that nominee, Buttigieg and Tulsi Gabbard are in fact combat veterans. Nobody can take away from the fact that they both served our country in that capacity. and they had a healthy debate around a very prominent issue that's addressing our country right now. And that is what's going on in Syria. So the fact that I don't like, you know, Tulsi Gabbard personally in the way she's conducted herself and the way I think that she's gotten kind of funding to get into this race, it is something that we as Democrats should be proud of and say, look, we have combat veterans that are potentially, they're running for the nomination of the Democrat Party. We have them included on this stage. They're debating this big issue right now. And we got good commentary out of it. Well thought out commentary. One side I agree with a lot more, but it comes from a standpoint of firsthand experience on both sides of that issue. And it's very, I don't remember that ever being a part of a Democratic debate.
No, you know what? That's a fantastic point. You're absolutely right. You had two on the stage. Last one I remember was John Kerry that was a combat vet.
I believe so, yeah.
I think so. You know, a lot of people listening to us don't even know who the hell he is, right? So yeah, it was really good to see. And you're absolutely right. That, and you know what else that does though, Frank? That leads a lot of credibility to what they're saying, right? Because even though, you know, we have our opinions about Gabbard, it still brings a lot of credibility to what they say simply because they were there, right? They have experience there. They did it. And
yep.
You know, you can't take that away. And, you know, if Buttigieg would get the nomination, because I don't think Gabbard would do this, but and the whole idea of anything happening overseas, in this case, it's Syria, or you know, Trump doesn't have much. He'd have a very difficult time defending himself against somebody who, you know, was ducking bullets in a desert someplace.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's the trend in the Democratic Party. If you look at Connor Lamb here in our, you know, in our neck of the woods, he's a Marine veteran and, you know, he's a fiscal conservative, but he's a Democrat on social issues. And, you know, he's able to come in and win a tough district that had been trending red more often than not recently. And he came in and won that. And you see more of that going on, you know, the Tammy Duckworths of the world, the Connor Lambs of the world. So I think that, you know, we're going to see that trend continue in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I certainly hope so because, well, let's face it, the Democrats need it. Whenever we come back, Frank, I want to talk to you about, I guess another one of Rudy's guys got nabbed at an airport.
Oh, this is going to be fun. I can't wait.
This is going to be good. So, we'll get into this as soon as we come back from break. Hi everyone, welcome back to the pod. Frank, you know what? Rudy's killing me. I mean, he's absolutely killing me. According to the Washington Post, a fourth defendant in Giuliani's associates gets arrested at a New York airport. David Correa, the fourth defendant in the campaign finance case involving business associates of President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudolph W. Giuliani. Holy shit, they used this whole name. Was arrested Wednesday morning at a New York City airport. They're not saying which airport it was. You know, because it was something and he's a piece of shit, I sure hope it was LaGuardia. Correa has been charged with participating in a scheme to use foreign money to build political support for a fledgling recreational, I can't make this shit up, marijuana business in Nevada and other states. Okay. According to an indictment unsealed last week that also charged Lev Parnas, P-A-R-N-A-S, and Igor Furman with conspiracy and making false claims to campaign finance regulators. Frank, you know what? If it was anybody else, it would blow your mind. But considering it's Rudy. It was JFK, son of a bitch. The defendant was taken into custody by the FBI at JFK earlier this morning, said Nicholas Bays, spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. That's unfortunate. I was really hoping it was LaGuardia because the place is such a piece of shit. I don't even know where to begin with this other than, does it really surprise you that it's one of Giuliani's dudes?
Not at all. You know, I think it's, see, well, let's do this. I really think we need to go here today. It's hilarious and it's scary in the sense that this man has reached the level of, you know, being the personal lawyer for the president of the United States. It's almost super villain shit, man. So let's go to that level. If we sat down and thought about writing a new character for Marvel or DC Comics and wanted to create the supervillain that would, you know, just really fuck shit up. What's his name? Like, what would you characterize him? Like, what is his, what would you call his nickname? And how's he going to dress in his supervillain suit? And I'm talking about Rudy, and now he's got his henchmen. He's got his four henchmen. Does anybody fit the henchmen any better than those guys?
I know, right? I mean, he's unbelievable. I'll be honest, Frank. I saw this today. You know, I was listening to, I was listening to Sirius, and you know, I got to listen to, Stephanie Miller, because I have to, because I love her and the folks she has on. She has great guests, and this came over the news at the top of the hour break. Just the actual news, not like her version of the news, but like the Sirius XM news. And I heard this, and I could not stop laughing. Honest to God, I'm just sitting here and I'm thinking, but of course these clowns are Judy or Rudy's guys.
So I mean, like, is his nickname Cerberus? I mean, he's like, he's got like underworld. you got to cross the river with him, you know, to get to Trump. I mean, I'm really serious. Like, what's his nickname going to be? This guy is like, he's that evil supervillain henchman with his henchmen. You know, he's got the alter ego where he was the mayor at one time and everybody like looked up to him and respected him, but that gave him the opportunity to find out how the, you know, to really be corrupt and use those inner workings to screw up society. It's like,
yeah, I think that background story is perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is. But at the same time, I mean, I'm looking at Rudy and I'm thinking, you know what? If there was ever a real life Dr. Evil,
yeah,
right, it's Rudy. There it is. You know, I don't expect him to pull out a bag of shishes for people, you know?
Yeah. That's a preemptive shish.
Right?
He would definitely use that on CNN on his next one if he knew, you know, if he got the reference, he would definitely use it.
He would have the shush app, you know? I mean, honestly, I don't mean to laugh at it because we are talking about the personal attorney for the president of the United States. And I guess the one thing that really stood out to me was I'm seeing all this, and you know, Frank, we have our history of folks like this, especially, you know, living in the part of the world where we live. And the only thing I thought of was, holy shit, we actually have a bigger clown than the president and the president's attorney.
Yeah.
It's staggering. I mean,
it is.
I'm expecting Boris and Natasha, you know, to be inducted anytime now.
Yeah, they're characters. These guys that Igor Parnas, I mean, they're characters. And how about the names of their business? Fraud and what was the other? What was the name of the nightclub?
Oh, geez. Oh, yeah.
It was like the Mafia Club or something, or
yeah, like the Mafia Nightclub or whatever.
Yeah, and it's like fraud expected or something. I can't remember what it was, but the one business.
Yeah, I mean it was hysterical, right?
Yeah, Rudy is, you know, he's we've been saying it for about a year now how crazy the guy is. And he's sitting there, you know, I mean, he's got to see that Michael Cohen was the personal attorney. And then Trump, you know, says, I never knew the guy. Like, he was never a very good attorney. I don't know what who he is or what he's all about. Meanwhile, he was his fixer for all that time.
Uh-huh. I mean,
where's Rudy think he's going next?
He's unbelievable. I don't even understand how these guys are. I mean, think about this. They are actually walking into the White House like they're all that in a bag of chips, right? And they're just one clown after another.
You know, David Shulkin. Do you remember David Shulkin, who was the Veterans Administration for a short period of time, about 18 months under Trump? He has a great article. I recommend you search it out and read it. And everybody that's listening to this, I recommend you search it out and read it.
I would love to hear this exactly how.
You can hear me, Master Patsy, but I hope you can. Can you hear me well?
Yeah.
So he details this meeting, and he talks about how Trump says to him, "What's the matter with the VA? How are we going to fix it?" And then Shulkin starts to talk about how he's going to fix it before he gets like three words of a sentence out. Trump interrupts him. He says, "I'll tell you what's wrong. Our veterans aren't getting the best care. We need to give them the best care. How are we going to give them the best care?" And he says, "You're absolutely right, Mr. President. Here's how we're going to do it." And he starts to talk. And 3 minutes in, the president says, "Well, I don't know about all that, but what I think we should do is really have a better secretary in charge of this. What do you think? How about our secretary right now? What do you think about him?" And then there's people talking all around the office, three or four people in their side conversations. And Trump's like interrupting every time he would ask a question, and never give a chance for the person to answer it. And then he'd look at his associates, who were Michael Cohen and Rens Priebus, and say, "What do you think about this guy right here? You think he's good?" And then before he left the room, he's like, "Yeah, next time you see me, I guess I'll be calling you Mr. Secretary." And that's how he made the decision that he was going to appoint David Shulkin as the Secretary of the VA. That's how much of a clown show is going on.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know what doesn't really surprise you? At least he doesn't have, you know, somebody at the VA who, you know, donated $1 million to his campaign.
Like that? Yeah. We never saw that happen, right? Never heard of Gordon Sondland, have you?
Right? Unbelievable. I'm gonna make a prediction though, Frank, and I'm not exactly going out on a limb here, but Rudy's going to jail.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you had to put odds on it, what do you say?
Oh, geez.
Even money?
Huh?
Even money, or are the odds even better than even money?
Oh, the odds are better than even. Well, the only, it would be even. Here's what I'll tell you: if they're straight up federal, then I'll say even money. But if there's any way that there's state charges involved in this, then I'm saying, oh my God, he has an 85-90% chance that he's doing that. Because what was that line in Pulp Fiction, you're not talking your way out. You're not talking your ass out of this one.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. He's not going to talk his way out of this. If the state's getting him, yeah, he's not talking his way out of this. Well, even if the feds get him, he's not. But he'll just be pardoned.
So you're saying basically you're going to have to lay 170 to win 100 on this one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. 170 to 100. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is. You know, Barcelona versus Ibar. Right? It really is.
Well, I it's going to be delicious. It's going to be absolutely delicious to watch it all unfold.
It really is. Before we stick a fork in this thing and wrap it all up, Frank, I wanted to kind of pull this a little full circle. We had talked about Rudy and going to jail and all that. Rudy also decided that he's pretty much going to ignore a congressional subpoena. Can you kind of explain to folks, you know, exactly how this whole thing works? Because if I remember right, and I think I posted it someplace. I don't know if it was for our channel or this part or whatever it was, but somebody refused a subpoena back whenever they were investigating Bill Clinton, and she ended up spending 18 months in jail.
Yeah.
First of all, is that's not a stretch, right? I mean, that's simply because she, lack of a better term, ignored a subpoena, a congressional subpoena. And number two, why do you think the Democrats aren't willing to pull the trigger on this as quickly as the Republicans were over, let's face it, what turned out being a blowjob?
Boy, I don't know. I think, you know, first off, I guess to answer your question, absolutely. There is no doubt that the failure to honor a congressional subpoena can lead to incarceration, because what they can do is use the enforcement arm of it by saying, look, in order to get people to cooperate with us as a governing branch of the government, we have to have a stick to enforce this. And they have, and they can continue to incarcerate people for failure to cooperate. In this situation, why aren't the Democrats doing that? Oh man, I really don't know the answer to that at this point, other than to think that I think
this is really a guess at this point in time, but I think that the best guess I have, they're accumulating going to be chips on the table for us that we're going to cash. The Republicans, specifically administration, has obstructed.
Here's all the evidence of the obstruction of justice. We subpoenaed this person. They didn't come. We subpoenaed that person. They didn't come. We subpoenaed that person. They didn't come. And, you know, why wouldn't you jail somebody? Because I think if they jail somebody, then you've got, what will likely happen if they jail somebody? And this is the effect that I think all of us want to see, the immediacy of it. Then everybody's going to start showing up, right? Because nobody wants to get their ass thrown in jail. You might have one person that stands on principle and says, okay, I'm not going to show up. I'll go to jail, right? But then after that example is set, the rest of these people are going to be like, their wives are going to be sitting with them saying, you better go talk to Congress. Uh-huh. You know, their kids are going to be like, Dad, you know, go talk to Congress. Your grandkids want you, you know, they want you home at Christmas. They don't want you sitting in jail. So I think that they are playing the long game on this, and this is totally a guess, but I think that they want to just use the appearance of it as obstruction of justice, as opposed to if they subpoena them and they show up and they, you know, after they jail one person and they say the rest of the people are going to show up, well, what's to stop the rest of those people from showing up and taking the approach that, what's his fucking face, the asshole that was...
It showed up in front of them and was real confrontational.
Oh, yeah. Lewandowski?
Yeah. Lewandowski. Yeah. I mean, so Lewandowski, all he did was fight with them the whole time. So what's to stop the next person from taking that stance and not giving them any real answers and just fighting like
with them the whole time? So I think they get more bang for their buck by using the failure to show and on an accumulated basis. To point to the obstruction.
Oh, you know what? That's pretty good. That's really insightful. And you're right. You know, throwing somebody in jail will get people to come sit in front of your committee, but that doesn't mean that they actually have to be truthful and answer you and just not do what that shithead did. Right. And so you know what? So far, as much as we get nervous and we complain and we wring our hands and we get real frustrated. Nancy's been right so far this whole time, right? I mean, she's playing this whole thing like a champ, so don't second guess her now.
I think that's it. I mean, we have to, we're all in on this. At this point, we have to kind of trust that process, so to speak.
Yeah, I think you're right. Great place to end the pod, Frank. Just absolutely brilliant as always. Is there anything you want to say or touch on before we throw this in the can?
The only thing I'll say is, you know, everybody stay focused, like we've talked about before. Be vigilant. You know, make calls to your congresspeople when you see things like this happening that you want to have stopped. I think our voices are still underutilized as a society. So I want, you know, all of our listeners and people that want to go in.
Absolutely. And like Frank and I always say, you know, your time is very valuable. And the fact that you're willing to spend any of that time with us means a great deal to us. It truly does. So on behalf of Frank and myself, until next week, same bad time, same bad channel. If you don't understand that reference, you're far too young to be listening to this podcast. So and until then, folks, goodbye, good luck, and God bless.
Tune in tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Butchered Sports. Raw and unfiltered, the way you wish your local sports anchor would bring it to you. Find us on Twitter at Butchered Sports and on YouTube at Butchered Sports. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Holy Sh** with Frank and Master Patsy. If you like our show, please subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to support us on Patreon. Join us again next week when we discuss the next thing that made us say, holy shit.